The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Politics, 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 politics.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics podcast for November 12th, 2021. It's your old pal, Justin Robert Young, recovering from a bit of a cold. That's why the timbre of my voice is even lower than usual. But we will not be stopped from doing a hell of a show for you today. First things first. We're going to take a look at the state of the Build Back Better bill. What is happening in the House? What is happening in the Senate? We heard from our boy Bill Scheer on Wednesday that he believes this thing is going to be passed sometime in early December. But if that's the case, then we're going to have to get moving on it at some point. Also, we have a bit of a kerfuffle in Buffalo. A progressive yub-nub moment in the primaries turned sour when an upset that put a progressive in line to be mayor of Buffalo was scuttled when the mayor who lost the primary ran a write-in candidacy and won. The progressives now want their comeuppance by stripping that mayor from his leadership positions in the national party. Will it happen? What are the details? We will get to those. Also, our boy Evan Scrimshaw is back because we are officially on Wave Watch. Yes. Yes. It's just the wave. We are going to see whether or not a red wave will topple majorities in the House and the Senate. We actually go a lot into detail on a announcement that was made earlier this week, and that is Chris Sununu deciding that he is not going to run for Senate in New Hampshire. That's a blow to Republicans. Is it a blow to their hopes of winning control of the Senate? Evan will tell us his opinion. But first, so let's take a look at the ever-evolving issues around the Build Back Better bill. Here's where we're going to start, because I'm a salty dog. We're going to start with the salt issue. That is the state and local tax deduction, which allows blue state folks to deduct high state taxes from their federal taxes. So basically, it makes living in a state with high local taxes more palatable because you are able to deduct them from your federal taxes. This was capped at $10,000 during the Trump tax cuts. That is how the math worked for them to give the tax cuts to other people, is to basically not allow people who live in high taxation blue states to get around paying their federal taxes. Now, this is something that a lot of the moderates that have very much pushed not only the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but whose votes are needed to get the BBB passed, are making an absolute non-negotiable, this thing needs to happen issue. They want SALT back the way it was, if not better. Now, the House and the Senate have different philosophies on dealing with it. The House wants to substantially raise the cap back beyond $10,000, and the Senate wants to means test this so nobody too rich gets to escape paying federal taxes. According to The Hill, the most recent version of The Hill's bill on BBB would raise the cap from $10,000 to $80,000, holding it at that level through 2030, the cap would then revert back to 10,000. But of course, once you go, you know, 8 years with these tax benefits, the great likelihood is that it will stay. Somebody will, especially the people that are voted in these districts, will vote to keep it as high as it is forever. That is the assumption. However, Bernie Sanders and Bob Menendez in the Senate said last week that they are developing a proposal that takes a different approach. They're going to keep the cap at 10,000 and make that cap permanent, but including an exemption from the limit for taxpayers with incomes under either 400,000 or 550,000. So if you make over 400,000 or 550,000 and you live in a high local tax state, so let's say New York, New Jersey, California, whatever, basically you would want to keep your you want to keep your income below 550,000 if you want to get a higher than $10,000 exemption. And this is all because, you know, look, a lot of millionaires and billionaires, the top 1% of the 1%, live in blue states and cities. LA, San Francisco, New York, where all the hedge fund people live in New Jersey. Like, these are very rich areas. So when you are allowing loopholes there, you are allowing loopholes for literally the 1% of the 1%. So there's that. We have no agreement there. I very much believe that the BBB is going to pass if just because there are moderates who very much want to make this happen and very much want to take SALT home back to their voters. But let's put that aside for now. Let's put the SALT on the side. Let's delve into when the BBB might actually be voted on. Now, remember, the House wanted to pass their version of the Build Back Better bill before they passed the bipartisan infrastructure bill last Friday. This was where all the drama was. Effectively, the progressives understood there was a need to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill. And so at the very least, they wanted moderate votes on the Build Back Better bill that was then going to be sent to the Senate. We're going to get to that in a second. The moderates said, no, we will not vote for this version of the Build Back Better bill. We need for you to send it to the Congressional Budget Office. We need to get a score on this bill before we vote on it. And so what they settled on was a promise. Pramila Jayapal of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which blocked not one but two votes on the bipartisan infrastructure bill in her attempt to keep these two bills linked, an ultimately failed attempt to keep these two bills linked, ultimately agreed that she would allow her members to vote for the bipartisan infrastructure bill and effectively de-link them if the moderates agreed that they would vote on it by the week of November 15th, next week, after they got information from the Congressional Budget Office. So this is Jayapal earlier this week making sure that everybody needs to know she means what she said. To clarify for everybody, the agreement that we made with our colleagues was not for a CBO score. It was for some additional financial information from the CBO. Agreement also says that in no event would the vote take place later than the week of November 15th. We trust our colleagues' commitments. So, vote's going to happen, right? I wouldn't bet on it. I just wouldn't. Some of the moderates are already making noise saying, no, 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 no. We need it to be scored by the Congressional Budget Office. And also, I don't think that there's a ton of love lost considering the fact that Pramila Jayapal, again, over the last few months, blew through not one but two deadlines that were promised to the moderates by House leadership. And of course, none of this really matters. because what's passed in the House is going to be used as toilet paper in the Senate, where this real deal is going to be crafted. And the man in the middle of that, Joe Manchin. Permission to come aboard. Joe Manchin is a financial moderate. Joe Manchin is worried about this week's big economic news. While many economic indicators are going in the right direction for Joe Biden, including declining unemployment claims, increased employment numbers. They actually had employment numbers beat expectations this month, which is a rarity and a welcome sight for Joe Biden. They weren't more than a week away from more bad news. The Consumer Price Index said that there is record inflation, 6.2% from a year ago in October. That is the largest increase since December 1990. Core inflation, stripping out food and energy, increased 4.6%, the fastest gain since August 1991. Energy, shelter, and vehicle costs led the gains, which more than wipe out whatever wage increases workers have received over the past few months. This is a problem. Yes, workers have had greater ability to come back at higher wages as America restaffs up, and there is a supply shortage, or sorry, a labor shortage. So workers have more ways to negotiate. However, if you account for the price of inflation, and this is hitting everywhere, food, gas, consumable goods. If that happens, then at the end of the day, you're actually making less money because everything else is more expensive. This is what Joe Manchin tweeted on Wednesday. By all accounts, the threat posed by record inflation to the American people is not transitory and is instead getting worse. From grocery stores to the gas pump, Americans know that the inflation tax is real, and DC can no longer ignore the economic pain Americans feel every day. Now, does that sound to you like somebody who's very excited to push forward beyond his comfort zone on a social spending bill that he has repeatedly in public, out loud, said is going to make inflation worse? If you're going to ask your boy, I would say no. I do not believe that that sounds like somebody who is ready to push forward on something more than exactly what he believes is proper. As always, friends, buckle up. But, you know, I made a bet with Jen Briney from Congressional Dish that the BBB would pass, and that still is my assumption. That being said, boy, do I get a bad vibe on all this. Like, it doesn't seem, you know, the progressives played their hand. It didn't work. Now the question is, well, how much do they give and how much do they complain about it? We haven't seen a ton of you know, rioting from progressives. There is some backlash on voting for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, but man, it just looks like there's bad vibes ahead. That's all I'll say. Buckle up. India Walton is the name of the progressive Democrat who, during the primary season, beat out Mayor Byron Brown to become the official Democratic nominee for mayor of Buffalo, New York. Stand up, WNY. Pull up a roast beef on Weck, because I got a tale for you. Byron Brown did not lay down. No, instead, he ran a write-in campaign. Now, in many states, this is illegal. Or it's hard. It's hard to get on a ballot in any way Well, I guess for a writing campaign, you wouldn't have to. But a lot of states have sore loser laws, is what I'm saying. Is that once you lose in a primary, it's hard for you to come back and run stuff. And even then, if you're in a write-in campaign, boy, does that take a lot of name recognition for you to have any chance to make this real. Well, Byron did it. Guess what? He won. The fact that Brown won has incensed progressives who believed that India Walton was going to be a big national story. And, you know, whenever you've got warring factions within a party, every once in a while you need somebody to give something to bind the two elements. And so for progressives, many of whom were really ignited through the 2016 run of Bernie Sanders, there has been this hope, especially throughout 2020, that, well, maybe now they'll take us seriously. Maybe after Bernie runs again in 2020 and has a bigger showing, but then plays ball at the end and doesn't stay in the race forever and doesn't, you know, make all the bad blood that he did with Hillary, maybe there is a path forward for this kind of stuff. And beating an established politician in a primary is one of them. Now, that same politician coming back and running in a write-in campaign seems to erase some of that goodwill. And so progressives are furious. And the way that they're trying to take it out is by, well, appealing to the mods, the heads of the national party. They say that they want Brown out. Any leadership position that he is in should be stripped. We quote Larry Cohen, chair of the Bernie Sanders aligned group, Our Revolution. When you pull a stunt like this, somebody wins a primary, a working class woman, and you go to every rich donor in both parties to fund a write-in campaign, it's a disgrace. Walton herself said not only should Brown be stripped, it sets a troubling precedent if he does not. So what's going to happen? Nothing. No, nothing's going to happen. I mean, look, I have said from the very beginning that the Democratic Party is a warlord party. It is only changed when you take tribal control of the party. Historically, Republicans were a little bit different. They were a little bit more cohesive because they got a lot more lifers that are like just party people in that organization, like the RNC. Now, that was upset a lot by Donald Trump, who came in and was very Democratic-like, a warlord that just took over things. Although now that he is out, and we'll see what happens over the next 2 years, but you've sort of seen an element of reversion. The old heads have survived. And yes, the Republican Party will be changed on some level, but there will still be consistency. My message to progressives has always been, either you win the presidency or you have no say. There is no amount of incremental change that will bring more respect from establishment Democrats to progressives. Not at all. You have leverage against their electability, and that's it. And even then, you've got to show them a path forward in terms of being able to win if you want anybody to give you a chance. Ladies and gentlemen, you can support this show by heading on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. It is quite simply the only way that you get bonus content from this program. It's our Patreon. You get a custom RSS feed. You can throw it in the podcatcher of your choice. And you, yes, you can get a bonus show on Monday morning, a bonus show on Thursday afternoon. That's our late edition. And quite frankly, it's like I'm recording this earlier in the week. I know it comes out on Friday, but I try to make it evergreen so it's still valid. But just the way that the cookie crumbles is that I record this earlier. If anything breaks between Wednesday afternoon and Thursday afternoon, the only place to hear my opinion on it is on our Patreon late edition. So treat yourself. As we're about to start talking about in our next segment, we are only 360 days away from the midterms. If there was ever a year that you deserve to have the full breadth of PX3, because remember in the midterms, they are not the same one narrative that everybody's covering. No. We've got a billion, just a cavalcade of stars, a glittering universe of narratives. And I'm going to be here to sort through all of it. Not once a week, not twice a week, like we have here on the free feed, but three times a week and four times a week if you are a member of our Patreon at the $3 level. So treat yourself to it and support the only crowd-funded national traveling reporter by heading on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 level gets you two bonus podcasts each and every week. There are 360 days from right now until the midterms. 360 days until we see if Democrats can fight back a red wave in the House. 360 days to see if Republicans can fend off a well-funded attempt to seize various governors' mansions. And 360 days to see if Cocaine Mitch McConnell will be the Senate Majority Leader yet again. So what will happen? Our guest today will help us figure it out in our far too early breakdown of the midterms. He is a columnist for thelines.com and a political betting analyst. You can find his newsletter on Substack. It is Scrimshaw Unscripted. Let's welcome back to the show, Evan Scrimshaw. Welcome back to the show, Evan.
Glad to do this. I always love coming on.
All right. So let's begin with where we had left our last conversation. You're going to have to eat a little bit of crow on Virginia, right? Because you were hard McAuliffe. Plus, I think six by the end of it.
Yeah, no. So I totally got Virginia wrong. And there's no hiding it. There's no running from it. There's no sort of blurring it. I got it wrong.
What did you get wrong specifically?
So two main things I got wrong. One, I thought that national partisanship was going to matter more than it did, partially because of the California recall, which we all remember was, you know, close for a bit and then sort of settled into, you know, a still considerable GOP overperformance from 2018. And then Gavin Newsom just did exactly as well as
he did back in his initial election. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other thing was that 2020, there were a pair of red state governorships up the same day as the presidential, and in Missouri and Montana, the two polls had been very close. Like the polls had been close or close-ish, and those polls were just completely wrong because state partisanship kicked in. And despite the fact that the GOP didn't have incumbents, they were in places with a history of electing Democratic governors, even while the state trended, you know, the states trended right at a federal level. And in both cases, the polls just missed and the states voted the way they voted. And the other thing is that I didn't think the GOP could sort of substantially or significantly outrun Donald Trump in rural Virginia.
Yeah. And whites without a college degree. I think even as I was tweeting about the exit polls, which showed that you were very incredulous to the idea that that was possible.
Yeah. And the thing is that I think it was the two districts with the biggest or two of the districts with the biggest McCall or Biden, where Glenn Youngkin did best compared to 2020 were Virginia 9, which is Southwest Virginia, and mm-hmm. Virginia 6, which is Western, sort of, I guess you might call it Northwestern Virginia. And I just didn't think, you know, 10, 12, 13 point overperformances in those areas was really possible, but it was. And that was sort of the big thing that I got wrong.
So in my mind, both of these things had to happen for Glenn Youngkin to win. Not only does he need to overperform in these red areas, but he has to also close the gap in some of the suburban districts that you have a very much kind of made your bread and butter on, fundamentally saying is a global realignment, right? That these suburban districts of college educated voters that might have at some point trended Republican are now coming home to the more liberal parties, not only here in America, but also elsewhere around the globe. Youngkin was able to close that gap. And from my point of view, being down on the ground in Virginia, it was because of issues like education. Do the results coming out of Virginia give you any pause to your global effing realignment?
So, I mean, obviously, everything gives me a little bit of a pause. I'm not arrogant enough to look at an election sure. that I got totally wrong and just sort of dismiss it. I will say that the swing in the Northern Virginia suburbs was smaller than the swing statewide. And if you look at Southside, sort of Hampton Roads, Richmond area,
yep.
So Youngkin needed three things to happen to win. He needed really good rural turnout and rural margins. He needed some suburban reversion, and he needed really bad Democratic turnout amongst non-white voters. And he got all three. Now, had he just gotten two of those three, he might have lost by a point and a half, which still yeah. would have been a horrible sign for Democrats in terms of 2022 prognostication or whatever else. But so the thing we don't know is how McAuliffe did compared to Biden or compared to Ralph Northam in white educated pockets, as opposed to doing worse in Nova in part or in full because he didn't get the same proportion of black voters out in those areas. Because even if whites with a degree in Nova are trending left, they're still less reliably Democratic voters than black voters. The other thing is that in New Jersey, where Phil Murphy, you know, got, you know, close to run down by
yeah.
Name I'm not even going to try and pronounce.
I believe it's Cicciarelli, but shout out to New Jersey, one of the few states in the union that can still statewide run a Cicciarelli. But
yes,
was that even on your radar? That was not on my radar at all, New Jersey.
So it's like one person DM'd me being like, do you have a New Jersey take? And I'm like, he wins by like 11. Yeah. Like he probably wins by like 10-ish. And like 11 is kind of your border of like, if he does better than 11, it's a good night for Democrats nationally. If he does worse than 11, it's probably not a great night for them. But like, I never tweeted that prediction because like, that was the most off the hip, like no data to back it up prediction. And therefore I'm not going to share that publicly, but in two highly educated counties, Phil Murphy did better than he did in 2017. And two of the biggest swings in the state were South Jersey counties, where I think it was like 18% in one district and 21% have bachelor degrees. And so even within that like horrible global result for Phil Murphy, he did better than 2017 in a pair of highly educated suburban districts and got smashed in South Jersey,
yeah.
where education's lower. And so you're still seeing a lot of evidence of the realignment. Virginia isn't the greatest sign, and it does suggest that the realignment isn't maybe as permanent for governorships, which could be interesting for 2022 to keep in mind, but you're still seeing the trend and you're still seeing things move in that direction.
And I think so. The big issue is that even while the blue areas do get bluer, the red areas have not stopped getting redder, which now kind of changes some of the calculus if you assumed that it was Donald Trump that was a unique animating factor there.
Correct.
All right. Well, that's that. And what we like having you here on the show because you do come up with your own fundamentals and you do loudly tout them. So we've got new evidence. And more specifically, we've got midterms that are officially now less than a year away. So this is going to be our way too early midterm rundown. And we do have a news peg for it. So let's start there. Governor Sununu of New Hampshire, popular there, was running ahead of Maggie Hassan in that New Hampshire Senate seat, at least according to polls over the last few months, announces on Tuesday that he will not seek that Senate seat. This would have been something that I think would have been probably devastating to Republican hopes to take the Senate 2 weeks ago. Is, while it's still very good news for Democrats, is it the same kind of bad news for Republicans post Virginia and New Jersey?
Yes, because the thing about the Senate is because we're talking about, you know, four competitive Democratic seats this year, right? New Hampshire, Arizona, Georgia, and Nevada. Like, even a, say, 20% drop in GOP win expectancy in just one seat is like a, you know, 5-ish% change in their overall Senate odds. And
yeah,
the thing is that I thought New Hampshire was the most likely GOP was the most likely state the GOP were going to flip. I understand that the New Hampshire GOP are not having the best time, but that's not Chris Sununu's problem. That is a state GOP problem. And yeah, Sununu has managed to inoculate himself from a lot of the sort of claims that they're a fairly extremist state party. He's a popular governor. He's going to clearly be reelected to his governorship next year because that's why he's running again. But I mean, I thought the GOP were Senate favorites after Virginia, but that was on the basis that they could flip New Hampshire. I thought that was basically, I don't want to say it was in the bag or anything, but I thought they were.
That was the most likely. I mean, based on what I would, you know, guess. I think, you well, know, when you're having, yeah, when you're having the, that dude run 5 points ahead in polls throughout the last year, like I would expect it.
Yeah, and the thing about New Hampshire is that there's a lot of people with still some residual ancestral understanding of, like, I can vote for Chris Sununu and I can vote for Republicans at various points of the ticket, even for a Biden plus, I think it was a Biden plus 7 state. And the thing for Republicans is that, because they just need one, right? It's a 50-50 Senate. They just need one to get to 51. And the problem is that, like, oh yeah, they should be able, like if you just think about this in a sort of like broad sense, you know, it's just like, okay, so they have to win a state that Biden won by 2, a state that Biden won by 0.2%, a state that Biden won by 0.3%, or New Hampshire by, oh, we'll just get to run Sununu and he'll sort of like shake up the state partisanship. And you're just like, well, they'll get one of them, right? Okay, well, Sununu's not running in New Hampshire. And Kelly Ayotte has said she isn't going to run for the Senate again. That could change. But if the GOP, like, other than those two, the New Hampshire GOP don't have any credible candidates to beat Hassan. Okay. Not great for them. In Georgia. And then you, if you go through
although,
the other
although
states,
I will point out before we move off New Hampshire that Kelly Ayotte did lose by, like, I think it was like 12,000 votes against Maggie Hassan. So it's not like,
not even,
like,
not yeah, even. No. If Ayotte runs, like, that's a credible threat to Democrats.
Yeah.
If she doesn't run and it's literally anybody else, Hassan's going to win again. But Ayotte is a very credible threat to Democrats. Yes.
All right. Well, then here, let me before we go through, let's do a little bit of news peg here. This is a crystal ball Senate rating changes that happened after the Tuesday races. They take Mark Kelly in Arizona, Raphael Warnock in Georgia, and Cortez Masto in Nevada, move them from leans Democratic to toss-ups, and Michael Bennett in Colorado goes from safe Democratic to likely Democratic. Let's start with Bennett. I presume that you don't think that this is a seat that even after what happened on Tuesday is really in play.
No, because the thing is that you could maybe sell me that Jared Polis, the governor of Colorado, might lose because state races are inherently less sort of federally partisan. You see that with Kansas, but I think the Kansas example sort of informs this pretty well for me, which is Kansas voters had no problem voting for Laura Kelly in 2018, had no problem electing a Democratic ticket for governor in a red year or in a blue year. And then the idea that they were going to vote for Barbara Beaulieu for the Senate was just like, no, there was no interest in federal vote splitting, but state and federal, oh yeah, they were totally fine with that. And I think that, you know, if the environment was bad, you could maybe see Polis in a tight race. They're not going to get rid of Michael Bennett.
Yeah. All right. Then if we assume that Bennett's a loser, then I'm going to give you those other three. Kelly in Arizona, Warnock in Georgia, and Cortez Masto in Nevada. We just had this big surprising result. I don't have the prices in front of me for any of these races, but I assume that all the Democrats are leading. If you're going to pick one as a possible upset, who do you like the most?
So I just read about this for my political betting column in the Lines this week. They're actually all underdogs. Like all of the Democrats are underdogs because the markets have massively overreacted, which is funny because I went into writing that column sort of expecting the same thing as you. It's like, oh, they're all going to be toss ups and I can sort of, you know, burnish some conservative credentials and be like, well, you know, maybe Arizona is a good buy. And the problem is that Democrats are all like 40, 60 underdogs in all these races.
Wow. So, I mean, those have to correct, right? Or else jump on him now. Jump. I mean, I think if you're just betting, then jump on Kelly, Warnock, and Cortez Masto now because they've got a better than puncher's chance of winning.
If you just want free money, Michael Bennett's down to 78 cents on predictor right now to win again, which seems absurd. But so the thing is that I think Warnock is the safest of those three. And I actually think him and Cortez Masto are, I still think they're going to win because we'll do Georgia first. Warnock is a black pastor with a proven ability to get extremely good black turnout, even in off cycle races. He can drive his own turnout in a very real and substantial way. The Georgia Democratic Party and the sort of Abrams machine, has proven themselves to be very competent in the last year. The runoff campaign that him and John Ossoff ran was immaculate. And to whatever extent you want to credit John Ossoff for that wizardry, and I think sort of consensus is that he ran one of the best campaigns of 2020 after running a horrible campaign in 2017. Ossoff and Warnock are still bros. They were at one of the Braves home playoff games together. And so, to whatever extent Ossoff, you know, might have been responsible for coordination or whatever else, he's still going to show up. He's still going to help out his Senate colleague. And Herschel Walker is a horrible candidate. He barely lives in Georgia. He's a nostalgia play for, you know, boomers. But I mean, all those people are already voting Republican anyways. And he's got the abuse allegations against him too from an ex-wife. But the biggest thing about Walker is that the sort of underlying assumption of running Herschel Walker is the Georgia GOP will get 12, 13, 14, 15% of the black vote. By running a black candidate, they will get this boost in the black vote. And that assumption seems highly, highly unlikely to me.
Yeah, I will say that there is a difference between running a black candidate and running Herschel Walker in Georgia. Like Herschel Walker is, and I think I agree with your pessimism that he is, for me, a very high risk, high reward candidate for the Republican Party. He certainly has the Trump blessing. He has tremendous name recognition, but I do think that he does represent a something more than just replacement level black candidate black Republican candidate in Georgia.
But the thing is, I don't know if his name recognition is actually that high because A, he's lived in Texas for like 30 years. And also, didn't he play college football in like the 70s?
I mean, I guess it might have started in the 70s. He certainly was
early 80s.
He was part of the big trade with the Dallas Cowboys in the late 80s that kind of set up their dynasty throughout the 90s. Yes. And I college football never dies in the South. The heroes that live there forever. SEC football is a religion, literally. And if that is the case, then he is one of the demigods in the state that he is running in. So I do think that it is more than just a candidate that would have a line in with the black community, more so than, you know, or to combat Raphael Warnock's. I think the larger problem with Herschel Walker is that he's never run a political campaign before. And he is somebody that we, you know, to me, it would not be shocking if we see a gaffe after gaffe after gaffe from Herschel Walker.
Yeah. And I don't think, I just don't think he can run the kind of disciplined campaign that Brian Kemp did in 2018, because Kemp managed to pull together an extremely good campaign where he was conservative enough to get extremely good rural turnout without saying enough to mess up his margins in the blood red exurbs, specifically Forsyth. And he won Forsyth, like Brian Kemp won Forsyth by 10 points more than Donald Trump did. And the path to the GOP winning Georgia again is they win Forsyth by 40, not 33. And I don't think Walker's brash, animated style, and I certainly don't think his past allegations are going to play well with the educated social liberals who, you know, like their tax cuts in Forsyth and in the sort of Georgia metro as a whole. And that's, I think, in some ways, even the bigger problem for Georgia Republicans is that they have to walk such a fine line between being conservative enough for the rurals, but being disciplined enough to still get your margins in and around Atlanta. And I don't think you can pull that off.
I share your pessimism in the end, and I generally would not be in any way confident with anything having to do with Georgia Republicans, considering we are about to get into a bizarre primary there with Trump having Raffensperger and Brian Kemp on his enemies list and everything that's going to go along with that. All right, so let's move off Georgia. Let's look at where do you want to go? Arizona or Nevada?
I think Nevada is the more interesting one, just because we've seen Democrats outperform national trends before in Nevada, right? Harry Reid came back from the dead in his 2010 race. It's a state that doesn't move a lot. Generally speaking, Democrats have a registration advantage in Clark County, or built mostly out of Clark County. And the thing about Nevada is there's like, I don't know how many counties exactly, but Democrats can literally win with one county. Cortez Masto won by winning Clark and losing every other county in the state. And so
I think it's like 60 or 70% of the population, if I'm correct, it's Clark County,
it's 70%, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is for those who are unaware, it's Vegas. That is Vegas. The other tiny little pocket of population is up near Reno. But by and large, you are running your campaign in and around, you know, the Strip, Henderson, all that.
And so Biden only won it by two, which wasn't a great result in the context of he basically ran even with Hillary, but he did two and a half points better than Hillary nationally. So that wasn't a great result. John Ralston, who is sort of the oracle of Nevada politics, has been, let's just say, deeply uncomplimentary about the campaign of GOP GOP Senate nominee Adam Laxalt, who lost the governorship in 2018. But the biggest thing is that, and Ralston has sort of made this point before, is that people talk a lot about like, oh, did the pandemic hurt Democratic campaign operations? I'm sort of, you know, bearish on the idea that like, oh, they would have, you know, come within three in Texas or whatever.
Yeah, I don't think that.
But But Ralston has said in the past that he thinks that the pandemic might have hurt Democrats in Nevada specifically to some degree, which makes me think that if Democrats can get the sort of Reid machine, can reconstitute that, can get that out in force again in 2022, they're going to be in a better spot. And I think the other thing is running a Hispanic senator when you're having some problems with Hispanic communities. I think that Cortez Masto is going to be a good candidate to make sure that the Hispanic slippage from 2020 doesn't get worse and might even get better. And Laxalt's not a particularly good candidate. He also suffers from the sort of carpetbagger problem of he doesn't really live in Nevada. And so I think Democrats should feel pretty good about that one.
All right. Then that leaves Mark Kelly. Do you think he's the most vulnerable?
Yeah, as of right now, yeah, because I think Hassan is, I thought Hassan was the most vulnerable until this morning. Now that Sununu is not running, I think it's Mark Kelly. But this is another one where the primary is really going to matter.
And so far the Arizona GOP has been a tire fire. Like they have been at war with each other for the last 4 years.
Yes. So you have the, I think it's AG, Mark Brnovich, who is trying to run as the like establishment candidate, who is trying to be sort of Republican enough to get through his primary without having to say anything too crazy. The problem with that is, and he has a good record of election. You know, he won pretty comfortably in 2018. How much of that was just Democrats weren't really focusing on his race? Yeah, hard to tell. But he at least is statewide elected, could raise some money. You know, he'd be a formidable challenger. And I think if he's the nominee, I think, you know, Kelly's in a, you know, toss-up race, might be, you know, the ever so slightest of an underdog. The problem for Arizona Republicans is Brnovich refuses to like deal with any of the like election truth ring. Like,
yeah,
Brnovich has said Joe Biden's the, you know, the duly elected president. And for everyone who says that, but Glenn Youngkin said the same thing. Glenn Youngkin didn't have to run in a primary, guys. Brnovich,
yeah,
does.
he was selected at the convention, right?
Yes, or exactly.
Whatever committee thing they did.
A convention literally designed at every point to be as anti-democratic as possible, so that he would win.
Yes,
because they were trying to stop Amanda Chase, who's nuts. And the problem for Arizona Republicans is that if Brnovich has to engage in basically election truthism, well, that's red meat for Mark Kelly and his reelect. But I don't know if he can win the primary without engaging in some election truthering. And if he loses the primary too, I think it's a guy named Blake Masters who is like I don't know if he has a Trump endorsement, but he's certainly the leading sort of like Trump cultist of the race. And if he's the nominee, Mark Kelly is going to lose to him. And that's the Arizona GOP problem of, can they get their preferred candidate through that primary and get him through sort of, you know, with enough of his reputation intact? Hard to say, which is why I think Kelly is still a slight favorite to win again.
Yeah, you know, I think that there is going to be a real interesting question, especially in situations like that, where will Republican voters in purple states be animated by pragmatism on a level that they might not have been in the past because they just saw what happened with Youngkin? Because they saw, like, all right, look, focus on these certain issues and we don't need to litigate 2020 again, and we don't need to, you treat Trump like a ex-president in a purple state, which is to say, thank you for your endorsement and move on. But you don't have to go through every single check down of his playbook. I wonder primary wise whether or not that's going to be an issue. But if there's one thing we've seen about the Arizona GOP, they are not. They're certainly not shy about making things very loud and very personal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing that might, because in 2010 and in 2012, right, the GOP threw away the Delaware, Nevada in 2012, Indiana, Missouri, by just running horrible candidates. And a lot of the people who voted for the same moderate candidates in those races, like, cannot believe I just referred to Dick Lugar as a moderate, but in that primary he was. A lot of them now vote for Democrats. The part of the global effing realignment is that well-educated, high-information voters tend to be Democrats now. And so you might end up seeing a situation where some of the people who were in 2010 and 2012 sort of standing guard against the crank ascendancy of the GOP, which was then the Tea Party, they're not there anymore to sort of hold the door, hold the line against the new crank ascendancy. And that could be a big problem for the GOP. I think less so in House races, because we generally don't, like, House candidates matter, but they don't matter on that kind of scale. And if the GOP are going to have the kind of night that they're going to have, it doesn't really matter. Like, the national environment is all that really matters for the House. Because you have, because even if you blow one or two individual seats on portable candidates, that doesn't matter so much for your, like you one or two races isn't going to move your overall House win percentage. But in the Senate, it really does. And if they throw away Arizona, like, your path to the majority just gets so much narrower, and you're relying on Biden being, you know, more deeply unpopular than if you were able to run, you know, moderate, sensible, reasonable candidates across those four states.
All right. Two last questions, and I'll get you out of here. What is your line for the House as of now? So if you were going to set the line of R plus whatever, D plus whatever, where do you have it now?
So I've got the GOP winning 225 seats right now. So my sort of expected House would be Republicans 225, Democrats 210, just because, like, the GOP are, like, they have to be favorites to win the House at this point. Like, if you're in denial
this is a change, because initially you were looking at the midterm saying that the Democrats might hold.
Yeah, and I still think there's a chance that they can hold, but yeah. I mean, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do? At some point, you know, there's sort of, you know, there's, you know, like, the reason I was optimistic Democrats could hold is that the polls that asked, the Jared Pallet polls, looked pretty good for Democrats. And then, like, I tweeted before Virginia, like, okay, one of these two things is wrong. Either the Virginia polls are wrong or the Jared Pallet's wrong. But one of these two things is wrong, because the Jared Pallet was basically like, no chance since 2020, nothing's happening, yada, yada, yada. And the Virginia polls were like, yeah, 12 point swing. Well, the Jared Pallet polls look pretty damn wrong to me. And so I'm a House pessimist. But the thing is that it's really hard actually to see the GOP gaining 20, 30, 40, 50 seats like the 2010 landslides. Because of redistricting, basically, Democrats are probably going to lock in 200 seats. Republicans are going to do the same, right? And so the battlefield that you're playing on is going to be so much narrower this time, as Illinois Democrats, New York Democrats, you know, they're gonna draw out a lot of Republicans, and so you're not going to see sort of House Democrats fall to the same extent they did last time. And I do think the GOP get a sort of, you know, slightly bigger than the majority Nancy Pelosi has right now, but it's hard to see how Democrats get to 218. They can get close. I just don't think they can get 218 right now, but, you know,
yeah,
Biden could get more popular in theory.
All right, so Republicans plus 15 in the House. What about the Senate?
Oh, if you would ask, if we'd recorded this yesterday, I would have said the GOP gain New Hampshire and nothing else changes. I think I'm going to say nothing. I think I'm going to say no Senate seat changes. But
so even?
No.
50-50?
No, I think Connor Lamb. I know. I still think Connor Lamb wins in Pennsylvania. So 51-49 Democrats.
Okay, so you would say the Democrats gain. So it'd be D plus one would be your expectation as of right now in 2022.
Yeah, as of right now. Obviously, things are subject to change and candidates won't matter. But yeah, I think as of right now, D plus one, 51-49 Dems.
All right, you've got a novel coming out.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, living in 2021 has allowed me to do is have a lot of time to write. And so just for myself, I started writing a novel earlier this year and I finished it. I kind of sat with it for a while and I decided it was good enough to publish, so I'm publishing it. It's a political story. It's a campaign story. It's, you know, a Canadian political whiz kid moves to the States for school. He ends up working on a Texas campaign, and he moves to Texas A&M College Station, and, you know, there's some campaign intrigue. He pledges one of the fraternities there. There's a guy he can't stop thinking about. Some stuff happens. I think it's pretty good.
There we go.
You know, if you want to buy it, it's my pinned tweet on Twitter.
What is it called? And where can people find it? On Amazon?
Yeah, people can find it on Amazon. Links in my pinned tweet, and the book is called Salvation in the Storm.
There we go. And then where can folks read your election betting writing?
So my election betting columns are at thelines.com. My general political writing is at scrimshawunscripted.substack.com. And you can find links to everything I've ever written at, when you follow me on Twitter, at escrimshaw.
Perfect. Evan, you know, we love talking to you here, and we are looking forward to catching up with you throughout this entire midterms as things continue to shift and change. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. This show is edited by Brett Stewart. If you would like to say thank you to Evan for pointing out some of the betting tips, giving us his insight. And I always like to have, I like Evan on mostly because he's got a breadth of knowledge. He's unafraid to say his opinion. And that's rare, especially in betting, where you get a lot of people that are like hedgers. But he is bold. And if we have him on throughout, you know, the series of the midterms, we can track everybody's political opinions. I really appreciate that. I think that you appreciate it as well. So why don't you go ahead and let him know that you do appreciate it. PX3Guest.com. If you want to email the program, it is theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Our Twitter is PX3Tweets. Our Twitch is PX3Live. Hopefully we were back on the air this morning. I was a little sick, so I hadn't gone on previously throughout the week, but I will be there more as I get better. PX3podcast.com is where you can share this very program with your friends and family. And of course, with the holidays coming up, politicsmerch.com if you want to get your friend, family, or loved one the gift of politics merch, PX3 merch. Just go ahead and do it right there, politicsmerch.com. If you want to support us, you can do so with a one-time donation, paypal.me/payjury. Venmo is justin-young-20, and our Cash App is PX3Cash. If you want to give me anything in the mail, you can do so, P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. Again, that is P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas, 78715. And of course, you can always get our bonus content at TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets your name read in the Titanic $10 tier, including Idris Arslandi and DJ Katie Mack, Niemeister, Dr. G, Lord Scale, Dekinse, Anile, Admiral Flapjack, Utah Jimmy Montana, Edmund Pluribus Unum, Pete Spicery, 70s TV Salesman or Spy, D. Really, and Gloria Young for King of the New World Order, Zombie Doc, Edison, No Mention on the Podcast, Please.com, Drunkie, DP4 Bungo, Jewish Lives Matter, 100 Mile Runner, Staff Sergeant Poopers, Double K Ranch, Pop Gold, Ye Old Pinball Shop, John, Snubbies Off Route 44, Neil, Charles, Darren, Olin and Angela, DL, Steven, Chad, Miranda Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert Casey, Paul, Robert D. Laser, Just Another Pilot, Middle Age Mike, The Gen, Will, J. Pink, and Andrew. If you want your name on that list, only one place to do it, especially as the midterms approach. That's TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Guys, I hope you have a great weekend. Hope you have a good restorative weekend. I can't believe that we are already getting into the holiday swing. We are already barreling toward my favorite holiday, Thanksgiving. I'm going to be back in the embrace of my family, which I have not seen at a Thanksgiving for many, many years. And it's something that I find pretty precious. So till next time, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss.
You have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.